of men servants, maid servants, I had to own. Such servants were born in my house, it is known. I had great possessions of herds and of flocks, surpassing the whole of Jerusalem's stocks. From Ecclesiastes chapter 2, that was verse 7, from the translation of Ward Green from 2020, and that's our daily proverb and scripture for today, little children. So coming back now again to the article, perhaps we should begin, let's begin with the Thor Heyerdahl movie called Kon-Tiki from 1950.
Largest whales live on a diet of plankton. The masthead lookout has caught sight of some large creature emerging from the depths of the sea. Quite right, it's a large whale. We were often visited by these leviathans. The first time a whole school or pod of these air-breathing creatures circled around our craft, we were rather scared. To start with, they kept a respectable distance, but not for long. Soon whales were popping up in every conceivable direction. And when they caught sight of the raft with us on board, some of them turned about and made straight for the Kon-Tiki. We realized that the largest whales were bigger than the raft, and we were scared of a collision when these huge creatures headed straight for us, and we had no more chance of stopping a whale in its tracks than of stopping this film.
Well, we've seen
the end of it. Into the water, and give it a tug as soon as you felt the fish bite. Carried not more than a ton of water, and this proved more than enough for the entire journey. After a while, we came to an area where there were frequent showers, and this gave us enough fresh water to travel distance, but not for long. Soon whales were popping up in every conceivable direction, and when they caught sight of the raft with us on board, some of them turned about and made straight for the Kon-Tiki. The logs in the stern were smooth and slippery, and anyone slipping into the water would be well aware of the many creatures milling around in the sea.
Okay.
By their smooth, shiny blowholes. But it would always dive just short of the raft, gliding down into the strait for the Kon-Tiki.
Right.
We realized that the largest whales were bigger than the raft, and we were scared of a collision when these huge creatures headed straight for us, and we had no more chance of stopping a whale in its tracks than of stopping this film.
We've seen that. I'll just let it play.
Snorting colossus of this kind will weigh several tons, and it was scary to be able to look straight down into their smooth, shiny blowholes. But it would always dive just short of the raft, gliding down into the translucent depths below our floating living room. Time and again, we could perch on the edge of the Kon-Tiki and look down on the broad, bluish-black back of a whale lying almost motionless in the clear water below. We knew that the whales often attack small boats, either crushing them or capsizing them with a mighty blow of their tail. But no whale ever threatened the Kon-Tiki. One might make straight for us at great speed, but would always dive in the nick of time. When the whales tired of frolicking around the raft, they'd disappear as suddenly as they had appeared.
Okay, we got to 27, so yeah, we're just about there. Okay.
After one of these visits, we usually checked the lashings. They often broke, but this was not because of the whales. The ropes holding the steering oar in place were constantly in need of repair. The logs in the stern were smooth and slippery, and anyone slipping into the water would be well aware of the many creatures milling around in the sea. By day, there would always be someone at hand to come to one's rescue, but at night, the man on the helm would be on his own. At regular intervals, we made a complete inspection of all the rope lashings. We carried spare lengths of rope, but only enough for a few logs if all the ropes disintegrated. But the experts had been quite wrong when they maintained that the ropes on a balsa raft would be chafed right through. As it turned out, the logs had no effect on the lashings, and the secret was quite simply that balsa is as soft and pliable as cork. The ropes, being harder than balsa, would dig deeper and deeper into the logs until they were completely protected in deep grooves. The radio operators had no easy task. The transmitter had to be watertight, and besides, there was not enough room on the raft to rig an aerial of any length. Robbie solved this problem by making a balloon. Our parrot was particularly interested in radio. Here she is seen closely watching Robbie's experiment, producing hydrogen for his balloon by mixing a special powder with seawater. Once the balloon is big enough, all Robbie has to do is to attach it to one end of his aerial, send it aloft, and get just the right length of aerial, the opposite end of the world. This in itself was a sort of world record. Here contact has just been made with a radio ham in Los Angeles, who had picked up our message announcing that we are halfway across the Pacific.
Here we are.
This means that after 45 days, we'd already covered a distance more than that between Oslo and the North Pole, which meant that we had exactly one half of our voyage left. We were now 2,500 miles from the nearest land. We were entirely alone in a world of our own. We often paddled off a considerable distance in our rubber dinghy whenever there was just a gentle swell. We never experienced a flat calm, however. We had two gales as we approached our halfway mark. One of these raged for 5 days and kept us too busy to do any filming. Our sail split, the steering oar broke, and the centerboard came away. There was also some damage to the deck, but we managed to repair most of it and continue calmly on our way. The elements were driving us relentlessly west at an average rate of 42.5 nautical miles a day, or about 80 kilometers. Our record for one single 24-hour stretch was 130 kilometers. We were constantly forced to make our way into the water below the raft to check the ropes and centerboards. This was an unpleasant task. Two men had to stand by and pull the diver up by his feet should a shark launch an unexpected attack. And had they failed to be vigilant and quick enough, the diver would have suffered the same fate as this fish dangling on a hook astern. With a snap of its jaws, the shark cut it in two. We were constantly followed by sharks waiting patiently to pick up anything thrown overboard. We fished shark for a very good reason. In fact, as well as to try shark meat, which tasted like haddock, provided it was sufficiently unsalted by rinsing in water. The main purpose of our shark fishing was to ensure that we got the shark before the shark got one of us, should anyone fall overboard. Lorita's greatest pleasure was watching our battle with the sharks. Hooking a shark was no problem. This creature has a voracious appetite and will eat just about anything. But this must be said to its credit, that it never attacked unless there was blood or fish offal in the water. But if there was, it would attack anything that moved in blind fury. On one occasion, a shark even sank its teeth into a corner of the raft. Once a shark had been hooked, hauling it on board the raft presented no difficulty. But once it was up on the slippery deck, the real struggle began. The brown shark has a skin so tough that it is proof against any knife thrust. To make sure that the great fish would not amputate a foot, or cut through ropes, or snap anything within reach, we had to tie it down securely. It would often lie on deck, trussed up, snapping viciously for as much as 3/4 of an hour. And as we sometimes had as many as 9 of these creatures lying on deck, it was often hard to distinguish between the dead ones and those alive. Sharks have small, cat-like eyes on the side of the head and have poor eyesight. They were always accompanied by their companions, the pilot fish, which would swim unconcernedly just in front of those powerful jaws, on the lookout for anything edible in the water around. Once a shark had been pulled out of the sea, his faithful friends would be at a loss. And in time, shoals of striped pilot fish had attached themselves to the victorious logs and swam on ahead of the Contiki in their typical fan-shaped formation across the ocean. When our parrot joined us in South America, she could only speak a few words of Spanish, but after 2 months, Danielson insisted that Lorita was speaking Spanish with a Norwegian accent. She came to be regarded as the 7th member of our crew. She provided a touch of southern temperament in a world full of so much cold fish. Lorita stayed with us for 60 days, but one day, when heavy seas pounded the Contiki, she was gone in a flash. As a rule, taking a dip in the sea was strictly taboo. but on hot days when the temptation was too great, if the masthead lookout assured us that there were no unwelcome guests lurking in the vicinity, we could venture out. On such occasions, there was always a life belt on the end of a long line trailing astern for the swimmer to hold onto should the Contiki slip away. This was how we usually enjoyed a refreshing dip in the Pacific with a firm grip on the raft. As a rule, the Contiki would drift at such a rate that anyone falling overboard would otherwise be a goner. One day, Watzinger found himself left behind, and although he swam like a man possessed, he had no chance of catching up with the raft. He was already some 30 yards astern when Haugland dived into the water with a line and managed to reach him in the nick of time.
Okay, so we'll stop there and return now to our article. We're at about 34 minutes and 42 seconds of this movie, which is just about 1 hour, but I think it's slightly less than 1 hour. Now, back to the article. The Ark of Urartu. Okay. It's been 13 years since I've really read this article, which was when I wrote it. That is, really read it. You know, it's been that long. So, you know, I could really do a lot of work preparing if I wanted to, but then I would just probably be talking too quickly, you know, and glossing over certain important things, whereas this way I'll be having to think harder while I'm reading it. So this paragraph includes the picture of the Wall of Heaven and Noah's Ark on the right middle ground. And I'm not sure if the shape of Noah's Ark, as shown here, is an exact correspondence to the drawing that Mr. Windsor gave us. Where is it, that drawing? Here it is, yeah. Right here. Yeah, right. But that's something to keep in mind, probably, or to think, something to that could be some food for thought. Among other, many other things that are food for thought with regard to Noah's Ark, of course. It's such a wonderful discovery that was made. Let's look up when it was discovered. Let's look up 1959. Yeah, it says the picture was taken perhaps in 1958 or 59. Well, we're going to see that in the next paragraph, at the end of that paragraph. So today's paragraph is chapter 1, paragraph 6. Now, the Hebrew word, which consists of three consonants, NSR, remembering that in the language of Sumeria, in the Epic of Gilgamesh, the mountain was called Nisir, N-I-S-I-R, the land, or the piece of land which was the mountain upon which the ship landed, Noah's Ark, that is. And that word in Hebrew, N-S-R, means, not that it should be in Hebrew, but just by the way, it means in Hebrew, eagle or vulture, or plank. It also can mean plank. So that's rather interesting, isn't it? All of those meanings seem rather interesting and appropriate for Noah's Ark landing on a mountain where it would be the only piece of wood on the mountain, The Gilgamesh epic said that the ark ended on Mount Nisir. Thus, from the description of the mountain as an eagle and also as a plank, we see that the ark landed high up on it, at least taking the Hebrew interpretation. It is only logical that the town of Uzengili, where Noah's ark now remains, is known as Nazar. Compare that with Nisir, NSR, right? It's the same three consonants, NSR, just with the two vowels being different. Nazar, that's the name of Uzengili. For that was the former name of Uzengili before 1948 of the Common Era. Dogubyazit is estimated to be 12 miles or 19 kilometers northwest. And Kazan, about 15 miles or 24 kilometers northwest of Noah's Ark. The Ark site itself is quite close to the border with Iran to the south. And the border tower is still visible on the hill. If a plane crashes on the border between two countries, where do they bury the survivors? This was an old joke, because obviously nowhere is where you bury the survivors. You don't bury survivors. Noah's Ark is impaled on a rock outcropping there at Nazar, now Uzengili, it's called. Caught there on the mountain in a mud flow. The place of first descent is higher up the slope, below a face called in the Epic of Gilgamesh the Wall of Heaven. Here a sheer rock face crowns the summit on the northwest side, rising some 300 feet as the diadem known as Mashu. There, it looks like a crown. It looks like a crown shape right here. You see this? The cliff itself looks like a crown. And that's conceivably, and so it's been proposed, the reason why Nimrod made himself a crown was because Nimrod was a king who knew about the Wall of Heaven and very possibly was there himself and saw this. So the crown would be just like the mountain crowning, or the peak, the being crowned by the cliff that looks like a crown. Somebody who saw that could make a crown for his own head. It makes... Doesn't it make sense? It seems to make a lot of sense. But, and that's something we can't learn from any writings, because, I mean, we do learn sort of very vague propositions like that, I guess, but not very specific ones that would prove that that's the case. But the thing is, I'm trying to think when the epic of Gilgamesh took place. Well, it was during the time when Noah was still alive, actually, apparently, in that story. So Gilgamesh lived before Nimrod. But Nimrod himself may well have followed the same route that Gilgamesh took, and Nimrod may have gone to this mountain himself. But he, of course, it's a long way to travel, isn't it? He would have had to travel from Babel, in Babylon, which is where the Tower of Babel is, and all the way north into Turkey, which is quite a distance. I wouldn't know exactly right now, but we could look into it. Maybe it's hundreds of miles, isn't it? I would think. Certainly a multi-day journey, anyway. Certainly very much not a short journey to go there and visit the Ark site. But here, this crown on the summit rises 300 feet and is known as Mashu. The word Mashu is the same word as MSH in Hebrew, with vowels removed, and becomes Moshi, drawn out of water. In other words, it's the name of Moses, whose name means drawn out of water. So that's quite remarkable also, or it's very similar to the name of Moses. And of course it was drawn out of water because the cliff would have emerged out of the floodwaters as the floodwaters receded after the deluge, and that's where the survivors, who were Noah, who actually saw this cliff, were able to approach it and then land the ark. The eight survivors, Noah and his three sons and all of their wives. In Akkadian, Mashu means twins. Akkadian being the descriptor for the kingdom of Akkad, you know, which was ruled by Sargon, who was a somewhat later king of Sumeria, or actually it wasn't Sumeria at that time, it was called Akkad or Akkadia, but in the same location. But the Akkadian word Mashu means twins, and it is the name of the first pitched camp. Now Sargon ruled about 2300 BCE, 400 years after the Tower of Babel. So and that's when Nimrod was, roughly 400 years prior to the kingdom of Akkad, so, or the dynasty of Akkad, when Sargon the first began that dynasty in about 2300 or so, as I think we'll see later in this article. But so he was 2300, Sargon. And that's probably where the word Mashu dates from, or somewhere at least that ancient. But then Nimrod was 400 years prior to that, 2700. So Gilgamesh, though, was probably sometime before that. And I think we've got some way of calculating when Gilgamesh lived. I'm not sure whether we do actually calculate that in our article. Let's see what we have here. Oh, we're going to talk more about him later, yeah. Yeah. So Gilgamesh lived evidently within 350 years after 3282, because that's when Noah died. So Gilgamesh, I mean, Noah died about, close to 350 years after the deluge, which is from 3282, that would be 2932, I guess. So 2932, Gilgamesh lived evidently prior to that, when he was speaking to Noah, or Utnapishtim, as he was called in the Epic of Gilgamesh. So continuing our study here, we're just about finished now. Mashu, right, it means twins, and it is the name of the first pitched camp at the place of first descent to the summit of Mount Nisir. Truly Misha of Genesis 10:30. We'll look that up. That's significant. Uzengili is also known as Mizar, or Mashar, I guess you would pronounce it, which compares with Mashu, right? So not just Nazar, but also Mazar. So N and M are sometimes interchangeable, right, in ancient languages. They both are related to water. In Egyptian, for example, the god of water is Nu in Egyptian. That's also the name for Noah, I think, in Egyptian. But also, so the N word is Noah in Egypt. That refers to the abyss of water that constitutes the deluge itself. That's the N word, right? In the time of, compared to the M word, which was the word for water in Egyptian. So M and N have those connotations in Egyptian. What else are we going to look at now? Oh yeah, the Genesis verse from Genesis 10 and 30. Let's go look at that. Genesis 10 and 30. This is very important, right? And their place of dwelling came to extend from Mesha as far as Sephar, the mountainous region of the east. And we'll talk later in this article about this place, Sephar, with regard to how far east it was and the significance of that, because this is why the article is called the Orient Express, too. That they went to the east, and the word Orient refers to the east. But the place of dwelling began at Mesha, which is this place on the mountain called Mashu. That town called Mesha is the first settlement made by the survivors who landed the ark on the mountain. And it perhaps remained a settlement there, even though, I mean, it seems to, it, there's evidence that it did, because there are remains, archaeologically speaking, on that site that show that people did live there, even though Noah and his family moved down, as there's evidence for that as well, into the village of Eight, as it's called. The village of Eight we'll talk about later in the article too. But this word Mesha is the word that is the most fascinating thing that relates to our paragraph today, that's from the Bible. This Mashu meaning twins, but also there's a word called the name, that is, for this town, which is Nakshuan. Nakshuan is also the name of this place of settlement, because this is at the place of first descent, in other words, the top of the mountain, the place of first descent where the ark first came down and landed. Right at the top, probably, right up here near the cliff, probably, they landed, right? Not necessarily on top of the cliff, but somewhere just perhaps below the cliff. Just, it's hard to establish that as to where they exactly landed, I think, but it would be a fascinating thing to try to investigate, would it not? And then we have the pictures, right? We have another picture here, too, which we've seen before, I believe, also, which is this picture from a slightly different angle, where the ark is seen much more visibly in this picture, together with the background, where you see the crown-like shape of the Wall of Heaven and Mount Judy on the right. Just a beautiful, beautiful picture, even though it's using very old camera technology nowadays, what would be considered very old camera technology from the 70s. This is, I believe, undoubtedly a picture by Mr. Wyatt, who did all the investigations with other scientists. He himself was not a scientist. He was an anesthesiologist, actually, in a hospital. He worked, therefore, in the medical profession, and he spent his money, or he saved up a lot of money, he saved up all his money, apparently. It's because he needed a lot of money to travel to these locations where he investigated all these things, such as Noah's Ark. And that wasn't the only thing he investigated, you'll see. He investigated the site of crucifixion, where he went underground and was investigating and found the blood of Jesus on the Ark of the Covenant underground, as he puts it. That's according to his words. And then he had that blood tested, and it was shown to have remarkable characteristics, which had only the chromosomes of the mother, apart from the sex chromosome of a male, which was needed to determine the sex or gender of Jesus. And that would be the chromosome that was put there by God, evidently, or by the Holy Spirit from God, so that Jesus would be a male who was born the Son of God. I hear my sump pump. I'm not sure if you'll hear that or not. So we're supposed to get rain today. Maybe that must be what that is, if we've got, or perhaps the pump just reached a certain level because of all the dehumidification that we've been doing and pumping water into the sump over time. It could be that, but we were supposed to get rain, but it was very questionable. So I went out today and shopped. Now, that's enough of our study for today, but isn't that a beautiful picture? I just love that picture of the wall of heaven with the ark. And it's such a vivid, beautiful picture of the ark. You can see it's so much like a boat, isn't it? Like, how could you say that was a natural formation, which is what all of these people have been saying for so long in the mainstream, you know, because they don't, or among any and all of the people who don't want to believe that it's Noah's Ark, if it can't be Noah's Ark, then it's got to be something else. So they come up with something else. It's got to be something natural. If it's not man-made, it must be something natural. And that shows how our theory influences our interpretation. And that's true of all of science. If you start out with a certain assumption or a theory, then everything you do is to try to fit the facts into that theory and make the facts fit that theory somehow, make the facts conform to the theory. And that's the way scientists do things, no matter what side they're on. So if we believe it is a boat, it is the ark, then we make the measurements such as we did. We measured it and we study the shape of it. We study the fact that it has these evident timbers on the side. We study it like a boat, you know, and we study, it's got the gunnels, in other words, the gunnels of the boat, right? Except it wasn't an open vessel. The top part was probably completely scavenged of all the wood so that they could build dwellings and burn firewood. And there was a lot of wood. This was an acre in area. This ark was so big, there must have been enough wood for many, many, many weeks, and many fires could be built with the wood from the ark before it was petrified, of course. But if we see it as a boat, we're going to interpret it that way. So that's it for today. It's September 8th, 2024 of the Common Era. The time is 17:09 hours North American Eastern Daylight Time. I'm Ward Green. Thank you for listening and watching. I love you very much. And in my behalf, this is Liv Dusty and this is Cassie saying bye for now.